from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson in This Week for Michael Krasny. According to a new survey, most Americans think they're pretty sharp when it comes to money matters. Over 75% gave themselves high marks. But when it came time to taking a test of a few financial facts, the numbers told a different story. Just over a third of those surveyed could correctly answer pretty basic questions like this one. If interest rates rise, what will typically happen to bond prices? If you're not sure about the answer, and only 30% of those surveyed answered correctly, stay with us for our next Answer of Forum as we explore what Americans need to know about money. That's ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson in This Week for Michael Krasny. There's never any shortage of numbers when it comes to assessing the economy, from the daily financial markets to the unemployment report. But how do Americans actually assess their own financial well-being? How many say they're able to save, pay their bills on time, or feel able to set aside money for retirement? And how many feel confident about their own financial smarts? The latest installment in an ongoing study of how Americans answer these questions is out, and in this hour form, we'll explore what that survey tells us about how Americans see their financial health and what that survey also tells us about our own financial literacy. Joining us to take up this topic this hour is Jerry Walsh. She's president of FINRA Investor Health. That stands for Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. That's the foundation that put together this study called the Financial Capability in the United States 2016. Jerry Walsh, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us as well is Anna Maria Lusardi. She's Academic Director for the Global Financial Literacy Excellence Center at George Washington University School of Business and consulted on the study as well. Anna Maria Lusardi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Very happy to be on this call.
Happy to have you be part of our program as well. And here too in our studio is Adair Morse. She's Associate Professor of Finance at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Professor Morse, thanks for being here, too.
Thanks, Dave.
Happy to have you all join us. Fascinating topic. Interesting to get a sense of how Americans see their financial health and how they see their own sense of smarts about their financial well-being. First to you, Jerry Walsh. You've been at this for a number of years now. This is a series of surveys and studies that you've done, large online survey of some 25,000 Americans. Give us the overall picture. First, how smart do Americans think they are about money, first of all?
Well, Americans tend to think that they're very smart about money. Pretty much most people, a vast majority of people, will say that they're very good at handling their finances, and they think that they're good at math. But we did take a look at how people feel about their current financial situation, which gives us a broader picture of financial capability, because it's not just what you know and how you feel about what you know. It's how you're feeling about your day-to-day reality and how you're managing your money and whether you're planning ahead. Those are some of the other areas that the survey explored.
And we'll be exploring all of those things in some detail over the course of our hour. But let's talk first about the conundrum that's revealed to some extent in your study, that about 75% of all Americans think they're pretty good at managing their money. But when you put to them a basic series of questions about whether or not they could answer a series of things that pinpoint to some degree their knowledge of basic financial questions, they didn't do quite so well. Tell us what you learned about that and what that revealed about their ability to answer a basic series of questions. How well did people do on your short quiz?
Well, they didn't do very well at all. In fact, most Americans nationwide did quite poorly. They were unable to get four or more questions correct. But the interesting thing about the self-perception is that 75% or so that you're talking about, people think that they're good at managing their money, but then when you ask them what they do when it comes to day-to-day financial matters, such as managing checking accounts or credit cards, they think they're really good. good. But even among those people that give themselves the highest score, 42%, you know, 3 in 10 of them are engaging in costly credit card behaviors where they're paying only the minimum that's due. They're paying late fees. They're incurring over the limit fees. They might be using their card to get cash advances. 42. I mean, that's huge. 18% of the people that say that they have the highest score, they are the best at managing their money, 18% of them use some kind of non-bank borrowing like a payday lender.
Before we get into all of those kinds of behaviors and the dangers of them, I want to talk some about the kinds of questions that you raise and get a sense from our audience as well about what that tells us and whether or not these kinds of issues are important in terms of what you really ought to know about how you manage the money. And I want to go first to the question where people perform the poorest and whether or not that's an important thing for people to know. And the question where people did the worst was this one. If interest rates rise, what will typically happen to bond prices? Let me read it again. If interest rates rise, what will typically happen to bond prices? And the choices were, this was a multiple choice question, bond prices will rise too, they'll fall, or they'll stay the same, or there's no relationship at all. So interest rates rise, what happens to bonds? Do they go up too? Do they fall? Do they still stay the same? Now, not very many people got that answer correct. Why is it important, Jerry Walsh, that people know the answer to that question?
Well, if people are investing for their future, and we do see that quite a few people are investing in stocks or bonds, it's important that they understand how those securities markets work. And separately, we have been in, quite unusually, a long, sustained period of low interest rates. And so we're not seeing the kind of growth, even with fixed income products, that we have been seeing in the past. So it's important that people understand that if they've purchased an investment and interest rates are going, you know, in a certain direction, the value of their investment is going to change sort of in a reverse proportion. That's important to know.
And Adir Morse, let me bring you into the conversation at this point on this, because I know you have a somewhat different take on this. Again, the question of interest rates rise, what happens to bond prices? As Jerry Walsh was just describing, the answer is that bond prices will fall. Only about 30% got that answer correct. Another 30% said they didn't know. Only 18% got it correct. Your feeling, though, is that that may not be such a crucial thing.
My view on this, it's very important to understand what decisions matter. And I commend the authors. It's just wonderful research they're doing here. But if we think about what decisions matter, so knowing how to follow if they have bond investments, knowing how to follow how the prices go up and down with the market, does that mean they should be repositioning all the time and understanding these dynamics? I mean, the first question is that going to help them have a balanced portfolio that they should have for their savings? And the second question really is, who are we talking about in the first place? About a little over half of the population doesn't invest, a little over half does invest in financial markets. And many of these are investing through 401ks and these kind of products. And so the decision process for many Americans, first of all, doesn't even involve stocks and bonds. And maybe it should, but it doesn't. And then even if they are, yes, there's a diversification question and people should understand that question. But the fact that they can't follow the prices of bonds with interest rates moving, I'm not sure this is first order for the kinds of literacy questions that we are really going to help people. Now, I'm all for people understanding the markets, but when we take this one question, which people did poorly on, and then say that people really don't understand, I think we're not giving people enough credit for what they do understand, some of these other questions.
So what to you are the most important things for people to understand more broadly?
That's a great question, Dave. So the diversification question that these authors have is really very important, that people understand that investing in a mutual fund product or a pool of different stocks is less risky than a single stock. So that's the question that they do ask, and about half the population gets that right, and the other and 40% say they don't know the answer.
So let me just interject for a moment, Professor Morris. This is the question, and I'll want to get your comments on this as well, Anna Maria Lusardi, on this. But this is the sixth question in your quiz was, buying a single company stock usually provides a safer return than a stock mutual fund, and is that true or is that false? As Professor Morse is just saying, the answer, of course, to that is false. And most people did get that one right. In fact, that probably was one of the best scores. And that's a key thing to get right.
Well, a key point here is even though a lot of people said they didn't know, they're not getting it wrong. So there's a difference there. And the authors, of course, know this. But sometimes the media, the way that we take these reports – and it gets written up that people are not making the best decisions and they're not literate. I think we need to take that with a grain of salt. They know the answer about the interest rate that saving if you put your money in, it grows, right? They generally got that question right. And these things are really important. People understand saving versus spending a little bit. You know, that's we're getting that out of this. And so we should give people some credit rather than just focusing on the negative. I'm not saying there's not negatives here, but a little bit of credit to just the average folks in learning how to manage their finances and over time.
What I hear Adair Morse saying, Jerry Walsh, is that maybe in these sorts of assessments of overall financial literacy that we ought to weight things a bit more, that your question six in this case, that the question of knowing that you're really better off if you put your money in mutual funds where risk is spread out than sort of putting it all in a single stock, may be a more important thing to know than the relationship between bonds and interest rates. And so maybe we ought to give people a little bit more credit for getting that one right than the question of bonds versus interest rates. What do you think about that?
Well, a couple things. One is that, you know, the assessment is six questions, and it's meant to have easy, intermediate, and challenging questions in it. But it's a six-point scale, and overall in the survey, it was six of close to 100 questions. I know that Anna Maria Lusardi, who's also on the line, has done a lot of work with researchers internationally to validate different kinds of questions that can provide a baseline assessment of financial literacy. And that's what, you know, the big three are part of the scale that we have. But it's, you know, the survey is meant to look more broadly, not only at financial literacy, but also behaviors and attitudes.
Right. And we'll definitely be getting into all of those really interesting things that your survey reveals as well. But Anna Maria Lusardi, let's get your thoughts on this question. In terms of what the quiz really tells us about how adept Americans are at knowing what they need to know about where their money ought to be saved, where it ought to be invested, and whether or not it reveals something important about their either what they do know, as Adair Morse is suggesting, or what they don't know.
Yeah. So, you know, we don't want to necessarily have a negative attitude toward this, in a sense, knowledge, but I do think there is a somewhat negative finding here. First of all, I want to say, you know, we are talking about financial literacy, and I love the word, not financial in this case, but literacy. What we are really going after is really the basic knowledge, the knowledge of the fundamental concepts at the basis of financial decision making. And, you know, in a sense, in an industrialized society, if you need to be able to read and write in the 21st century, you need to have this basic knowledge, this financial literacy, because every day each of us is making financial decisions. So I actually do think they are fundamental concepts. And as in the past, you know, not everybody is going to be tested or is going to, you know, write a book or a literature book, or, you know, is going to do very complicated calculation or use these writing and reading skills. So today, the level of financial decision that people make differ across them, but each of us is making financial decisions. And that's why in our question, we ask about simple knowledge of interest compounding up to the bond prices. The bond prices question is actually one of my favorite ones because it allows us to differentiate among level of financial sophistication. Indeed, we don't expect a lot of people to be able to know this concept, but it allows us to actually know where the people who are more financially sophisticated. So I think there is a little bit of negative finding, and I'll quickly conclude, which is that if you look at the number of questions that people get correctly, you know, this is a small number. When we compare the U.S. with other countries, actually the U.S. doesn't seem to be doing, you know, very well either.
What is it that we ought to be doing differently, Adair Morse, whether that's K through 12 or at prestigious universities where both you and Anna Marie Lusardi are, University of California, George Washington University, to get people smarter? And what is it that we ought to be getting people smarter about? What is it that in the year 2016 that it is particularly crucial that we be improving people's financial literacy about?
So I feel that Professor Lusardi and I will differ. We go way back on this answer. Professor Lusardi has been doing research on financial literacy for a long time and wonderful studies. And surely literacy matters for outcomes. But what we haven't found is that education programs are that successful. And what we know is that if you get people to think through situations, and particularly at the time of the situation, if they think through, if they're empowered with not being afraid of numeracy, not being afraid of thinking through the fine print on mortgages and giving them disclosure that they can then empower their own thinking and their own experience and using their own experience in just economics and finance and day-to-day living, that the decision-making really improves just with conveyance at that point in time. So your question is about what we should be educating people. My answer is educating on economic critical thinking, and the research differs on this, on whether we should be training people from the very beginning to know these concepts of bond prices and these sort of things, or we should be training people to think, you know, having them live situations and think through what decisions they would make, whether that's in college doing role playing with financial games or just economic thinking and supply and demand. And my view is that it's not the content of the bond prices and this sort of thing, but it's getting people to be able to think so they can, when they're approaching it, buying a car, what is the kind of payments that my budget can handle? How do I think about putting away money for college for kids and just basic things that are not specific about education, but are specific about empowering ourselves to not be afraid to do a few calculations and think on the spot.
So real life, particular situation based on everyday kind of decision making point, real life points where you have to make these choices.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How would you take that further, Anna Maria Lusardi, and apply it to what ought to be done within a curriculum? Do you disagree with Adair Morse's point of view on that?
I disagree a little bit in a sense that, in my view, just-in-time education is too late. People are making important decisions before they get to that point. Think of like having a mortgage for your house. You know, you decide much, much earlier, you know, which house would you like, which house you can afford, and making and providing information when you are in front of the mortgage broker might be too late. I actually really think it's critically important that we provide people with the basic skills they need to achieve that critical thinking that Adair Morse was highlighting, which I think is really important. So, you know, we need a combination of characteristics, and experiential learning can be very important, but so are knowing the basics of those financial decisions, which is, by the way, what we do in all the other courses as well.
Jerry Walsh, one of the things that's evident in this latest iteration of your survey is that we're not getting better, according to the data that you've collected. In fact, it shows that we're slipping back a little bit, which must make you scratch your head a little bit about how we can get better in this country at improving financial literacy. What are your thoughts about how we can up this? Because these challenges will only get greater as society gets more complex, as finances get more complex, as the challenges, as fraud becomes more of a problem, as all of these things get more complicated in the 21st century. It seems like we need to do better, and yet we seem to be slipping further back.
We're slipping back in some ways and according to some measures, but we're actually doing better as a nation in other ways. Attitudinally, people feel better about their finances. We see evidence that more people are saving. They're engaging in fewer costly credit card behaviors. More people than ever before are paying off their balances in full each month. Part of that is a reflection of the economy and the job market, but part of that is, you know, people coming to understand, having had a very dark experiential learning session in 2008, 2009, 2010. So we are seeing some areas where there are improvement. But if I may, I'd like to address the financial education element. There are some important projects out there in the field trying to understand the impact of financial education, say in the K through 12 space. And there's a researcher at Montana State University that the FINRA Foundation funded to do a very rigorous study using data from the Federal Reserve, their credit panel, to take a look at the long-term impacts of financial education programs. And what they found is that if there is a rigorous financial education program that's carefully implemented, it actually can improve the credit scores and lower the probability of delinquency and credit behaviors for young adults over time. So there is starting to be some evidence that K-12 financial education works, but what matters is how that education is mandated. How rigorous is the program? Does it, to Professor Morris's point, encourage critical economic thinking? Mm-hmm. Does it equip people to make those kinds of decisions? And is it tested? Is it something that people are required to have achieved in order to graduate from high school?
Let me hold you there, if I might, and we'll pick up on that thought and a lot more when we return, because we do have to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about not only how we can educate people more to improve their financial literacy, but about the specific challenges we face, whether that's with credit cards or saving for retirement. We welcome your calls as well. If you'd like to join our conversation and ask questions about this, you can join us at 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in this week for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, financial literacy in the United States. How much do people know about finances? And do they know what they need to know not only to manage their finances, but how well are people doing in terms of the basic challenges that they face, whether that's managing their credit card debt, being able to save for retirement, being able to plan for their futures, being able to save money for their own children's college education. A new survey is out, a large online survey of Americans, a survey that's been done since 2009 by FINRA, that's the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, their foundation. Is out that gives us some interesting data, not only about how well Americans do when they answer a series of questions that assesses their financial literacy, but also says something about their behavior, how well they're doing with paying off credit cards, how well they're doing in terms of being able to meet their own financial obligations, being able to save, being able to put away money for retirement and college education and so forth. So this hour forum, we're talking about all of that. And we want to get your thoughts, too, about how we can do better in terms of getting smarter about finances, do better in terms of managing our financial wherewithal. We can take your questions at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Here to take your questions are Jerry Walsh, the president of the FINRA Foundation, Adair Morse, associate professor of finance at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, Anna Maria Lissardi, the academic director of the Global Financial Literacy Excellence Center at George Washington University, who is also a consultant on the study. Number of interesting questions and comments coming in on email. You can email your questions to us as well, of course, at forum@kqed.org. Let's go right to our questions. First, and go to Chris in Menlo Park. Chris, go ahead with your question.
Hi there. So I'm a financial planner. I've run my financial planning business in Menlo Park for the last 9 years and working with individual clients on how to put together a good plan. And I think one of the points that you guys are making that's so spot on is about literacy versus just information. I think before the age of the internet, people were looking to financial advisors for expert information they couldn't find elsewhere. And now what I'm actually seeing is information overload, generic advice everywhere they turn, online, from friends. And so sussing out kind of what the right strategy is I think, where that literacy concept becomes so important. And I just was curious on kind of your thoughts on how you may have seen those results on the survey or research change over the years to reflect that.
Chris, thank you. Anna Maria Lissardi, any comments on Chris's observation?
What we find, which is going to his point, is that it's the people with higher financial literacy that consult financial advisor. You know, so people think that they are actually substitute, that if you don't have financial literacy, that's why you use advisor, and the opposite is true. And what the data has actually been showing throughout the year is this important finding. And I think it's because, you know, people have an information overload, or the more you know, actually, the better you are also able to use advisors.
One of the things that came through in the survey, Adair Morse, that I'd like you to comment on is, and this is, of course, not surprising, the disparity that comes through demographically, that there is, for example, that with Hispanics and African Americans, there's much more use of things that we know are not helpful in terms of how you manage your finance, much more widespread use of payday loans, of pawn shops, that those are used 39% by African Americans, 31% by Hispanics, used much less by whites. That there's a much higher proportion of younger people who fall behind when it comes to paying their mortgage, much higher problems with younger people, for example, sometimes having problems with credit cards and the like. What in your own work and in your own focus on this particular area, what does that tell us about our state of financial well-being and the problems that and the particular challenges that people in this country have, who people of color, people who are of lower income?
So let me divide those into age and then thinking about race separately, because I think there's a distinction in much of the academic research. The role of learning and experience in products, in financial products, really does show up in terms of better use later, in terms of when people get to middle age, say, the mistakes that we often document in credit card use and things, they decline. And so the younger mistakes, if you will, we should give people some credit. The American population learns, right? We may not show up with enough financial literacy in day one when we're out there on our own. And we make mistakes and they're costly, but there is some learning over time and that's encouraging and hopefully we can do better on that front. Now, that's not exactly what your question was fully about. Your question is, there are some people, whether they're young people or there's people of color or of different race or status in life, really, is a better way to put it, that use these products more. And when we present the figures as statisticians, we put those figures out there, you know, that Afro-Americans use payday loans more, we have to pause and think, does this have anything to do with race at all? Or should we be thinking about the cross slices of, you know, what kind of education people have been exposed to and what kind of income prospects or in the volatility in income in families and the support systems and all these things factor in. So we should be a little bit more careful along those lines. But it's absolutely important to know these figures so that we start attacking where we can make progress and help these people.
And Cherry Walsh, on that point of Adair Morse's about the more widespread use of things that we know are not healthy financially to use, like payday loans or pawn shops by those populations, what efforts is FINRA or others making to try to use, whether that's outreach, educational outreach efforts or others, to try to make that effort possible so that those kinds of products aren't used as much by those particular population groups?
One approach that the foundation has been taking is to work with local nonprofit partners to try to coordinate efforts that bring affordable products to demographic groups that might otherwise need to rely on payday lending. And so, for example, in partnership with United Way Worldwide, the FINRA Foundation over the past 8 years has been working in collaboration to identify community-based partnerships where, you know, a local credit union might be partnering with a local United Way and an employer to bring small-dollar loans that the employer sponsors into the community, into that demographic that might not have great credit, but has a financial emergency. One of the things that we see is that there's a failure of precautionary savings across demographic groups. At the higher end of the income spectrum, people are a little bit better, but kind of across all the demographic groups, we're not doing so well when it comes to having a rainy day fund. And so making some of these kinds of products available to people, helping the community figure out what works within that community, that's something that can be very critical.
And back to our calls. Let's go to Rhett next in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Rhett, go ahead.
Yes.
Oh, we lost you, Rhett. Sorry. Call back if you would, please. We'll go next to Jesse in San Francisco. Jesse, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. A couple of comments about I was raised by hippie parents, so my financial education was limited. I dealt with disability, and I'm still dealing with it. So it was important for me because I was so unemployable to find something outside of my usual box. And I think that the box that I was raised in was the one that we're all raised in of employer-employee. And I read Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and got one very good idea about it, out of it. His thing is that you should get away from the employer-employee model and try to find passive income, something that makes money for you while you walk away. And that was really critically important for me. But I, you know, didn't have the upbringing to know how to do that kind of stuff and to look for it and all that stuff. And also I've noticed going through the social services system that by and large, they don't think in that way either. And there are so many people that are not employable for one reason or another that require some other model than employer-employee or even just, you know, handout model or whatever it's called these days. So, and then the lady was talking a moment ago about loans. When your rent is three times your income, and that's like for the studio apartment, I mean, we're seeing this in San Francisco, where it's like the system itself has to change its metric in some very fundamental way to where your expenses are a fixed percentage of your income and not this, you know, this thing we allow where it could just skyrocket past it. So there are all these issues that feed into this, the social justice issue and everything else. But for me, I was really happy to get that idea of passive income. So for me, my skill sets were around publishing.
Okay,
and
Jesse,
that's where I'm going.
All right, Jesse, thank you, and good luck. Best of luck with what you want to pursue. You raise an issue, though, that I would like to get some comment on from Anna Marie Lusardi. And one of the things that I think was concerning about the study that was that came through about just how challenging it is, I think, for everyone right now about just getting by. One of the things that was raised in the study was just how difficult it is for people to just get by, as Jesse was suggesting. That on average now, in terms of you, the study raised the question, how difficult is it for people to cover your expenses and pay your bills? And for 50%, it's either somewhat difficult or very difficult to just cover your expenses and pay your bills. For half, it's not difficult. What did that tell you? And how does that track over time, Anna Maria Lusardi, about the difficulty people have in just getting by?
That's a great question. So we see this in the data very clearly. You know, there is still a large part of the population which struggles not just with the long-term finances, but the day-to-day financial management. And this, I think, has gotten better over time. And so that's actually the positive result of this survey, which is, you know, as the economy starts to do better, also the finances of people are starting to do better, but we are still far away from, you know, a good situation. And I think the survey really brings to life, you know, the financial difficulties that, you know, the average American is facing. And in my view, that's why we need even more some financial skills. You know, for example, Jesse before, I think, was hinting to, you know, working more on your own. But that's, of course, raises even more difficulties that you really, in that case, need even more financial savvy.
It's a good point, I think, Adair Morse, because if you're going to work for yourself, you have that much less in the way of a safety net, that much less in the way of, and in these days, of course, even if you're working for an employer, retirement is less secure, you're more dependent on, you have less of a guaranteed retirement, less of a guaranteed retirement benefit. There's just less security in general.
Agree. But it's not specific to people working in passive income, is the way our caller said. It's a lot of people face income uncertainty going forward, and these have been changing times, and so this income uncertainty is very important. And you combine that with the work Anna Maria has about and the study of FINRA, that people are just a huge portion of the population as their income exactly the same as their expenses month to month, and they live month to month. And, you know, they optimize expenses. It may be that they have flexibility in what kind of housing or what car they drive or what other things, but they are not saving those people. And so you combine these things together and looking forward for the future, and you think about What do people really need to think about? They really need to think about their choices in spending today and retirement later. And that's true for everyone. It's a huge issue in the U.S. population.
One of the more sobering statistics, I thought, in the survey, Jerry Walsh, was that only about 50%, I guess, of those surveyed have what's considered emergency funds. And in another article that I read, a recent issue in the Atlantic Monthly, put it in an even more daunting way. They cited a study that had been done by the Federal Reserve that said that only half of all Americans could come up with $400 in an emergency. That's very sobering about how month to month, I guess, life is for most Americans. Jerry Walsh?
It is sobering. And, you know, the way that we have been framing it, at least Anna Maria and I in our discussions and other academics, is this concept of financial fragility. And, you know, while one survey asks the $400 question, we asked, could you come up with $2,000 in a month's time? So giving you a little bit of lead time. And what was shocking is, you know, overall, 34% of people said that they probably or they certainly could not come up with that amount of money. And when you slice and dice the demographics, you see that, you know, 45% of people who have a high school or less educational attainment, only, you know, so far fewer of folks who don't have college cannot come up with that money. They're financially fragile. So it's something that we see, and we see it across income levels. I mean, people who are making 75K or above, they've got no problem coming up. You know, 9 in 10 can come up with $2,000 in a month's time. But when you're looking at that under 25,000, and even in the middle demographic, too few Americans are able to come up with money.
And let's go to Adam next in Savannah, Georgia. Adam, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on, we're talking about financial education in the K-12 system. I actually had they called it home management math when I was in high school, but it was only offered to students who weren't on a college preparatory track in high school, and I found that my friends who didn't have the class in high school, I had it, they did not, fell into a lot more problems with credit card and financial debt and less understanding of tax systems in the United States. And I'm a huge advocate for it. I think it should be something that should be offered in public schools, private schools, as something that is something before you go to college you need to know.
Regardless of whether you're headed to college or not, it sounds like a useful idea. Adam, thanks. Thanks for that observation. Anna Maria Lusardi, you want to second the motion?
Yes, I want to second that motion and say that's also what the research now is finding, that indeed the benefit seems to be right away, for example, in how people manage that. But I also want to mention another feature of having financial education in the school, which is that it will provide access to people who otherwise would not have it. So one of the findings we have in other studies is that, for example, the young people who can be considered financially literate are disproportionately white male from college-educated families. So if we don't make financial literacy accessible in the schools, I am afraid that many people wouldn't have it, and we start right at the beginning unequal.
There's a comment from a website that I'd like your thoughts on, Adair Morse. This person writes in, the main reason for financial illiteracy in the U.S. is people's basic lack of math skills, which is a must to understand and deal with personal finances. This seems to be the case across society, including college grads. It's a fear of math. Some years ago, I tutored grad students at UC Berkeley Economics Department, and I was amazed at how poor their understanding of math was.
There's some truth to the fear of math and how that affects how we approach these large forms when we have a financial contract we're signing, whether it's you're buying a car or even your rent contract you're signing. And we don't stop and process sometimes because we don't want to do math. There is some truth to that for sure. However, if we were to make things more accessible in just the way we convey the math that people need to think through. Most people do an amazing job of living month to month, frankly. I mean, and it's actually getting better, as Anna Maria said, right? People are getting better at this, and that if you're living month to month, you're doing math all the time just to make ends meet each month. And so people have this fear, but yet they're doing it. So disentangling those.
So you've made the point a time or two that most of the research doesn't say yet that financial education, financial literacy programs has been shown through research to be effective. Jerry Walsh pointed to a project in Montana that has shown some progress. Adam called in from Savannah, Georgia, saying the
program in his high school that was designed for kids who weren't going to college, taught a lot. It doesn't seem like it should be that hard. I mean, to give you the basics, to figure out how to do things that you need to know in life. So why is it so difficult? Why can't we show what needs to be shown?
Yeah, I'm a finance geek. I wish I had better results to say about what we know thus far. And I think we should be teaching people how to think through their budgets and how to think through daily life and so forth. Whether that means we need to be teaching people things that are a little bit more complicated that may turn them off from finance, some of these concepts that are not relevant day one, maybe we need to just reassess what we are thinking and focus on our research in terms of disentangling what is sticking. Mm. Where our caller mentioned what's stuck, and that stuff is totally relevant.
So here's what you need to know if you're going to go buy a car.
Yeah.
So focus your education on that.
Yeah.
Okay. To Greg in San Francisco. Greg, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. Building on the conversation that's happening right now, I work at a nonprofit. We work with 3 after-school programs and partner with professionals and organizations to provide programming, and we really want to bring in a financial literacy program. Wondering if the guests have any recommendations or thoughts about how we would choose a high-quality program.
Greg, thank you. Thanks for the question. Jerry Walsh.
Absolutely. There are some networks that are also themselves nonprofits that have available free financial literacy curricula. So the Jumpstart Coalition for Personal Financial Literacy has a database of programs that are available. Some of them are very geared toward academic implementation. They've got teacher guides and the like. Others are more for the after school or general activities. There are also, lots of organizations, and while I can't endorse any of them, I mean, Junior Achievement, Operation Hope, Boys and Girls Club of America, they all have curricula. And so if there's a way for your after school program to reach out to local community providers, you might also consider talking to your local library, because librarians have been increasingly purveyors of financial literacy resources and financial capability building tools in their communities, geared toward their communities. So that might be a great resource as well.
Greg, thanks for the call. Next to Linda in Berkeley. Linda, go ahead, please.
Yes. I keep seeing these ads on TV for corporations offering to buy your debt. They say if you have more than $5,000 worth of debt, that they will buy your debt. Are they legitimate? And if they're not, are there legitimate corporations or entities, nonprofits, that will consolidate your debt and help you to pay it off in a reasonable manner?
Linda, thanks. Jerry or Anna Maria, any thoughts on that?
Sure, happy to provide some. One of the things that I always caution people, whether it's credit card debt or student loan consolidation outside the federal programs, you need to ask yourself whether this service is going to give you something that you could do yourself. And how much does it cost? With any financial transaction, you always want to know about the costs. And for something like debt consolidation, 2 of the costs are not only what you pay up front or off the top to get the job done, but if you're going to be consolidating your loans or your debt to a point that you're going to be extending the payment period, even if the interest rate is lower, you may end up paying more interest because you have extended the period of your loan. So before you use a debt consolidation service, one of the things that I would encourage you to do is to, seek out a nonprofit credit counseling organization. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling has information. We've got a load of resources on our website at saveandinvest.org. Also, FINRA.org has a wealth of information for financial consumers.
Linda, thanks for the call.
couple of points before we have to wrap up our hour. One listener wants to know if the test that we've referenced here from this study is available to take online, and it is indeed. We've posted it on our website, so if you go to kqed.org/forum, you can take the financial literacy test that the FINRA organization put together. A couple of last questions. Peter asks, the companies that hold my IRA send me reports 4 times a year. These little booklets contain a message from the CEO and pages and pages and pages of numbers, which I have no understanding of. Is it important that I understand them? Adair?
It's important that you understand what's in your portfolio and the risks you're holding. And so if you're holding specific companies and you're exposed to not having enough diversification, that's important that you pay attention to what kind of risk you have in your portfolio and that you have the right mix of stocks and bonds, saying that you're balancing what your life cycle savings goals are and things of that nature. Understanding the details of each of those pieces in those reports, I don't think anyone that's not a professional in the area delves that deeply. But, you know, that doesn't mean we should just kind of ignore risk. And a lot of that is put out for you so that you know, so that liability-wise, you know that you're exposed to risk. So getting the big picture of your risk in your portfolio is really the most important thing along those lines.
We have to wrap up our hour, but a brief last takeaway. Anna Maria Lusardi, as someone who consulted on this study, what would you like people to think more about, I guess, as they begin the rest, as they begin their work week and think about their finances?
I would like them to think about the fact that finances now are really personal. In a sense, you are your own CFO of your finances. And I think it's really important for everybody to take charge, to be in charge of them and to take responsibility for these decisions. They are complex, but they also allow us to be, you know, better, more financially healthy.
Thank you. Thanks all very much. Thanks to Anna Maria Lusardi, to Adair Morse, and Jerry Walsh for participating in our conversation. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producers are Amanda Supai and Jeremy Siegel. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schaefer-Wolf. Our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.